The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has confirmed the government is looking to cut the civil service budget by 15% by the end of the decade. That's an annual reduction of £2 billion by 2030. Downing Street says it wants the savings to be made to back offices. It insists the public will not notice any changes, which unions dispute. Rachel Reeves says Whitehall can be made more efficient through increasing the use of technology and artificial intelligence. The Pope has made his first public appearance in 5 weeks as he was discharged from hospital to return to the Vatican. He offered a blessing from a balcony of the Gemelli Hospital in Rome, where he's been treated for double pneumonia. 88-year-old Pope Francis waved at the crowds gathered outside and thanked them for their support. The Pope has also called for an immediate end to Israeli strikes in Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry in the territory says at least 30 Palestinians have died so far today, bringing the total number who've been killed in the conflict to 50,000. The Israeli military is continuing its renewed attacks in Gaza, mounting a ground offensive against Hamas in Rafah. Ukraine says a Russian drone attack on Kyiv has killed 3 people, including a 5-year-old child. At least 10 other people were injured. The Russian Defence Ministry says nearly 60 Ukrainian drones were shot down by its forces as they flew over the southern Rostov region. The opposition mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, has been formally arrested on corruption charges in a case that's triggered major protests across Turkey. Mr. İmamoğlu is the main political rival of President Erdogan and is about to be nominated as a candidate in the next presidential election. Popular musicians, including Sir Elton John, Annie Lennox and Coldplay, are backing a call by the singer Ed Sheeran for the government to increase funding for music education. Writing to the Prime Minister, Ed Sheeran says £250 million is needed to repair what's been called decades of dismantling music. He says learning an instrument has become a luxury not every child can afford. And the weather: rain in the north easing this afternoon, but the southeast of England will see some heavy showers develop. A dry day elsewhere. And top temperatures this afternoon are 15 Celsius in London, 13 in Cardiff, 11 in Belfast and 9 in Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News and Weather. It's 2 minutes past 12. Now, here's Michael Barclay.
The set and costume designer, Bob Crowley, says he creates other worlds. The stage is where his imagination runs riot at the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Company, the Royal Opera House, the West End, Broadway and beyond. He's won numerous Olivier and Tony Awards for memorable designs, like the brightly lit revolving horses for Carousel, magical black and white tissue paper drawings evoking the foggy London skyline for Mary Poppins, and couture dresses and the River Seine for An American in Paris. He's also worked on many new plays, including The History Boys by Alan Bennett. His most recent credits include Richard II at the Bridge Theatre in London with Jonathan Bailey in the title role. Well, you've brought us a very wide-ranging array of music today, Bob, including Talis, Gershwin, Schubert. But I think we're going to start with the opening scene from Verdi's La Traviata. Why did you home in on this?
Well, I love everything I've chosen today, obviously, that goes without saying. But, you know, it's Sunday and it's lunchtime and it just sounds like the, and tastes like the best glass of champagne you've ever had in your life.
You worked on this production with Richard Eyre at the Royal Opera House, which has been running for a long time.
Yes, it's 30-odd years now, yeah.
Did you feel that you needed to do anything new with this, or actually was it very much in the tradition of opera?
Well, it was fascinating, actually, because, you know, with any of these shows I design, there is a myriad ways of designing them and directing them, obviously. But on this occasion, Sir George Shalty was the conductor, and he had design approval. And so Richard and I had to go to his house in St. John's Wood. And we were met by his lovely wife, Lady Valerie Shalty, and she took us into his lair, his studio, which was extraordinary, extraordinary. It was just wall-to-wall Grammys. It was like the Grammy concession or the Grammy shop or something like that. And I had to present my designs to him. I was very nervous of him at the time and his reputation. You know, he was known as the Screaming Skull, I think, by the orchestra members. And I just said to him, Sir George, what is it you want to see? You know, when you look up from the podium at the stage, he just said to me, I just want to see big frocks. So, you know, there was no other way of doing the show, really, but big frocks.
Well, the big frocks are swallowing. Here we go with the drinking song. The Brindisi drinking song from Verdi's La Traviata, performed by Angela Georgiou, Frank Lopardo and the Chorus and Orchestra of the Royal Opera House, conducted by George Shalty. This was Richard Eyre's first directorial efforts in opera. He was in charge of the National Theatre at the time, yes. So he was no beginner. But I wondered what it was like working for Shalty. Was he the boss, did you feel?
Yes, he was. You know, I still love the way he'd come into rehearsals every morning. He'd arrive like a prize fighter. You know, he'd come in with a white towel around his neck. You know, he went into the pit like Robert De Niro in
Raging Bull.
You know, he looked like Jake LaMotta, you know. Yeah. Putting on an opera like that is a gargantuan piece of organisation. So one man has to be in control of that, and obviously the director is in terms of the production, but it's the man in the pit who has ultimate control, yeah.
You reminded me just now when you said about Raging Bull how he used to conduct with sort of muscular shoulders.
He was. He was a prize fighter. Yeah.
When you're designing something, how much inspiration do you get from listening to the music?
A lot. I mean, music is a big, big thing in my life. I grew up with music and I don't come from a particularly musical family or anything, but It's always been there. So I would immerse myself. Even when I'm designing pieces that don't have any music, like plays, I am listening to music constantly. Some of the selections today would surprise, I think, some people who know me very well, because it's kind of music I do listen to on my own. I don't share it with people, even my own studio. You know, it's very difficult to put on anything in the studio that everybody can agree on all the time. And theatre and all of these things are a collaborative form. You know, you're not on your own. You're dealing with a director, lighting designers, choreographers, in case of opera and ballet, composers. But the actual grit in the oyster happens on your own in a room. And so it's very singular. And I always have music on.
The human voice appears in a lot of your selection,
yes.
Indeed in the next piece. And I wonder whether this talus is something you play privately or
it is.
Publicly.
Yes, it's private. I think a lot of this music is private music, actually. This was quite a daunting task to reduce it to these pieces. But I didn't know anything about Thomas Tallis when I was a young man. I was introduced to him, but it was a record of Vaughan Williams.
Fantasia.
And the Fantasia was the first thing I heard. And I mean, I love Vaughan Williams, and I love folk music as well. And I love when music comes from folk origins like that, like his music does a lot. But the talus, I didn't understand it. I still don't quite understand it. I mean, I know what it's saying and the biblical themes and things, but there's a total mysteriousness to it to me. It's unlike anything else. God, it's so beautiful.
How to say something wonderful in 2 minutes, 11 seconds.
I know, it's not even the 3-minute pop song. It's astounding that there's so much in that. It's so condensed. And the other thing I think I realise when I put this list together, I love harmonies. I just love the human voice when it harmonises. Maybe it's a very early thing from pop music in the 50s and 60s, like the Everly Brothers, you know, and when you hear two siblings sing together and those voices are so, so close. Or even like the McGarrigle sisters. And it's just one voice, but in two parts, really. I just find it absolutely irresistible.
It says something timeless about human communication, doesn't it? Hearing those inner voices move against the outer ones that almost give a skeleton which the inner voices flesh out.
Yes, and a cappella, you know, I mean, there's no huge orchestra behind it, and it just floats in the air. I mean, I'm not a particularly religious man, although I find it hard to walk by a church, and I'm an inveterate candle lighter. But, you know, I grew up in a very, very strong Catholic family.
In Cork?
In Cork, yes, in the 50s. I had a full sort of... They weren't Jesuits, but they were a form of Jesuits.
Well, I was going to say the full Monty, but that would be the wrong expression.
No, it wasn't that, if only. It was quite the opposite. It was very dour, and, you know, they all wore long black robes. And when I went to Mass, I couldn't really believe what was going on in front of me. I tried, but I just couldn't make the leap. I loved the smells and bells, and I loved choral music. I loved the hymns. I still love hymns. And the concentration that you get in a church. Theatre in the church taught me a lot about ritual, I think, and how you place things in space. And then it all changed when the priest turned around and then faced the audience, the brethren. But there you go.
Your dad was a farmer?
Yes, he was. He was a very, very gifted man who grew up in a time where he couldn't really make use of his gifts. So he was a frustrated furniture maker. I mean, he made virtually everything that was in our house. The bed I slept in, the wardrobe I kept my clothes in. He would run into burning buildings, for a living. And then when he wasn't running into burning buildings, he was in his workshop in the garage at the back, making old, beautiful, antique things that he'd find come back to life. He was a very gifted restorer.
Did he encourage you to make things with him?
No, he was a very solitary man in that respect. I was watching him and I was seeing him do everything. But it was a bit like that Victorian childhood where, you know, your children were meant to be kept slightly apart from their parents. You know, you had your own life to lead. And I was a kind of a solitary child.
But was creativity going through your mind? Was there music in the household?
There was music in the house in the form of records, yes, LPs. There was no television, and the radio was a major thing. You know, we had one of those very tall radiograms, whatever they were called. And I used to sit on the edge of the armchair and twiddle with those knobs and go across all the dials.
Hilversum.
I swear to God, Michael, it's here in front of me. I have Hilversum as my favourite word. It's on this old transistor radio that we got later.
Hilversum was a station, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I think it's in Holland or Belgium or somewhere like that. It is a place. But, you know, Luxembourg, obviously, was a big one. And you'd look at Tashkent. I mean, like, I'd never left the area of the city I was growing up in, you know, and let alone think where Hilversum was, but it is a beautiful word. And I do love words.
And did you get to see musical productions, and was there one that made you think,
It was a version of the original Oliver production, which another fellow Irishman called Sean Kenny, who was actually a trained architect. He trained with Frank Lloyd Wright, and then he became a stage designer. But I saw a version of his set, and it was a Damascene moment in my life where I realised that you didn't have to do things with backlots and things like that, stripping it all away and revealing everything. And it was a totally Brechtian version of Oliver. And that made me think, what is this? And I began to try and find out.
It's a Yeats poem set to music by Herbert Hughes we're going to hear next.
This is done by the Sally Gardens, which, I mean, I'm a bit of a sucker for all that Celtic Twilight things. You know, I do love all that. And I do love Yeats. And it's a very beautiful, beautiful tune. And Maura O'Connell, who's got a very beautiful voice too.
Down by the Sally Gardens, my love and I did meet. She passed the Sally Gardens with little snow white feet. past the Sally Gardens with little snow white feet. She bid me take love easy as the grass grows on the
Down by the Sally Gardens, that wonderful poem by Yeats, set to music by Herbert Hughes there, and performed by Maura O'Connell. Bob, you applied for a scholarship to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, and I wonder what it was like leaving Ireland for England. Were you nervous, trepidatious?
Yes, I didn't actually apply for a scholarship. They gave me one. I didn't know anybody in England. A friend of mine gave me a subscription to a now defunct theatre magazine called Plays and Players, and in the back of it was the name of the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, and that's the only one I knew. So I wrote off to them and they gave me an interview, and I turned up. The door was opened by this wonderful woman called Erica, who's still a friend of mine, Erica Newman, and she let me in through the door and then introduced me to two men. One was called Anthony Rowe, and then the principal of the school was called Nathaniel Brenner. And I had a rather ragged old portfolio with me of stuff. I had done work in Cork in an amateur theatre company, and I had three or four things under my belt, but I really didn't have much faith in them, although I was very passionate about wanting to work in the theatre. Nat, who was rather frightening and kept a matchstick in his teeth all the time, I remember when he was interviewing me. One of his discoveries, one of his best friends was Peter O'Toole. I think he just saw something in that portfolio that I didn't. Anyway, he let me in and I never turned back, really. He was so kind to me, so kind to me.
So you'd already been thinking in stagecraft?
Yes. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was kind of a bit of a lost soul in that respect. I thought maybe I wanted to be an actor. I just loved the theatre. I loved being taken to theatre. I'd been taken to theatre as a child by my grandparents. I was the kind of child that I would be dragged along. I would go anywhere and see anything. And I was taken to all these shows. So my grandparents had a kind of Victorian household, really. And my grandfather played musical instruments. I would never go home after school every day. My mother would always go down to this house and I would go there. There was a lot of music in that house and a lot of singers in that house. He would sit by the fire and he would play songs on his mandolin and his accordion. And he wouldn't let us put the lights on in the house. He just said, just listen to the music, watch the fire and watch the twilight happening. So he created such an extraordinary atmosphere there. And I think I owe a lot to that family, really, you know, and that upbringing.
At what point did you encounter ballet, Petrushka, I think, in particular?
Yes, when I went to Bristol in the first year there, they gave us a project which was to come up with some designs for it. I have never seen the ballet since, or I've never designed it. But on the LP of Stravinsky, there was Pulcinella.
Which is a more neoclassical
piece. It just hooked me. And from that moment on, I became obsessed with ballet and watching it and seeing it.
Thank you.
it's that pull, that tug, that almost like a backbeat, you know, that you get in reggae. I know it's not that, but it's that pulling beat in the middle section completely gets me every time when I listen to it. Almost like a piece of lace around it, you know, it's beautiful, yeah.
It's beautiful. Like a very danceable lament, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, and the different strings are just creating different atmospheres and textures. Oh, it's just gorgeous.
The second movement, Serenata, from Stravinsky's Pulcinella Suite, performed by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Kurt Mazur. Bob, do you start when you're beginning a design with a kind of blank piece of paper?
I do.
What is it that triggers the first movements on that?
I know, it's the tabula rasa, you know, it's the blank page. Everything begins with a pencil and a white piece of paper. What Paul Klee called taking the line for a walk, you know. And I don't know what that is when the pencil hits the paper, if anything's going to happen or not. So, thankfully it has. Not always, not always.
And do you or your colleagues make models?
Yes, they are models. We make extreme...
Your father would have liked that.
Yes, he would have loved all of that. He got to see some of them. He was at the opening night of Traviata at Covent Garden, and he came to New York to see one of my big musical opening there. My mother, unfortunately, didn't. She died quite young, which was a great regret of all of us, really. So, but yes, we make these very beautiful, detailed scale models. I can't really realise what I'm doing until it goes from a drawing to a three-dimensional space.
Yeah, I think it was Peter O'Toole who helped you to get your first sort of big break in the business.
Well, that was both a blessing and a curse, really. He did. He saw a production of Midsummer Night's Dream that I'd done at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre as a young designer. The phone rang in the studio one day at King Street, and someone said to me, I've got Peter O'Toole on the line for you. And I thought it was a piss take, but then this inevitable Peter O'Toole voice came on, and it was him, and he wanted me to work on a production of Macbeth with him. I headed off to London to meet him, and there began this extraordinary kind of doomed production, really. It was my first outing. It was my first big break, and it was a nightmare.
Why?
Because he had this vision of the play, which I thought was... I mean, I was totally in awe of him. I sat in front of this beautiful man, always beautifully dressed, and he always wore velvet slippers. He'd keep you waiting for hours, like superstars do, and then he'd arrive looking astonishing. But the green velvet slippers, I remember that very vividly. But he was working with a film director, Brian Forbes. The way they went about this production was not how I wanted to do it. And I mean... It wasn't that I was being arrogant or anything about it. I just couldn't agree with their aesthetics. And I just couldn't do it. And I nearly had a nervous breakdown. And I eventually had to leave it and walk away from it, which was not an easy thing to do because of my connection with Nat Brenner at the theatre school, who loved Peter. And, oh, God, it was very complicated, all of it. But the show infamously opened to the worst reviews ever.
So you'd made the right decision.
Well, I had made a decision. It was a big moment in my life and a very clarifying thing of sometimes it's just easier to say no and better to say no than carry on doing something that you know is going to make you miserable and unhappy. But I did go through a really weird time after that because I kind of lost my confidence for a while there. And but bizarrely, I was doing a production of The Duchess of Malfi with Helen Mirren and Bob Hoskins at the Manchester Royal Exchange. That was happening virtually at the same time, and that became a huge success. That turned my life back on again. Then I got all my confidence again from working with Helen, who was just so kind to me and so amazing to me. And Bob, they were all such lovely people. And so I got, everything came back, and that was a massive success, and came to London to the Roundhouse. And I didn't look back from there, really. That was it. So, you know, you win some, you lose some.
Baroque polychoral music next.
Yes, now this is a recent discovery. Some of this music I've known for, you know, 50, 60 years. But this I came across by chance about 2 weeks ago. And again, it's like one of those things that, you know, it stops you in your tracks. It's the voices again. I know nothing about this composer.
Orazio Benevoli, a Franco-Italian composer of large sacred polychoral works. And the interesting thing is the instrumental lineup: sackbuts, which are trombones, cornet, and the regal, a small portable organ. So here it is, part of the Magnificat for 16 voices.
Thank you.
It's just unbelievable, the complexity of it, the density of it, and the texture of it. It's so beautiful. It's so rich. It's so rich.
Part of the magnificent Magnificat for 16 voices by Orazio Benevole, performed by Le Concert Spirituel, conducted by Hervé Niquet. Bob, you spent about 10 years working with the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yes.
And, of course, that was the days of Les Liaisons Dangereuses,
yes,
wasn't it? With Alan Rickman, Lindsay Duncan.
Yes.
In fact, I think that was your first show to transfer
and
to Broadway.
Fiona Shaw was in the original production as well, yeah. And Leslie Manville. It was an incredible cast. I did a lot of Shakespeare. I did nothing but Shakespeare, really, for 10 years. The 80s is kind of my Shakespeare time. But in the middle of that arrived this extraordinary script by Christopher Hampton, his adaptation of the novel. That was just one of those things landing on your doorstep. I mean, I just couldn't put it down. And that, yes, became a huge success at Stratford, at the other place, directed by the late, fabulous, my dear friend, Howard Davis, who I miss every week. And that transferred to the West End and then went on to Broadway and then became a Hollywood film as well, which I wasn't involved in.
I don't think I can resist making you blush by reading you the very descriptive review from Frank Rich in the New York Times on the 1st of May 1987. For the Royal Shakespeare Company production of Les Liaisons Dangereuses, the stage at the Music Box Theatre has been remodelled into a sex-drenched boudoir of late 18th century France. Signs of reckless carnal abandon are everywhere. Huge linen sheets, rumpled from hectic use, drape the proscenium and boxes. Lacy silk underthings tumble in messy profusion from the hastily slammed drawers of a tiring chiffonnier. Tall, slatted screens, the better for servants to peep through, cast distorted shadows. All that is missing is a proper regal bed. Instead, there's a constellation of settees and chaises longues. This is an arena for men and women who copulate on the run.
Oh, my God. Words fail me. Honestly, that's just a description of my living room at home, really. And, I mean, it's ironic because I was known as like a total minimalist. You know, there was an actor, a lovely actor in Bristol, Kevin Lloyd, who named me Fight for a Chair Crowley. You know, I put nothing on stage and suddenly this 18th century extravaganza is all mine too. I'm sorry. There's several sides to me.
Is it really important when you're doing something like that to find just the right chaise longue or chair?
Yes. Again, that was something I learned from the fabulous Nat Brenner. He was a total Brechtian in his beliefs. First of all, he said, it's the poets that matter. That was the first thing he said. He said, poets matter. Poetry matters and poets matter in the theatre. And I've never forgotten that. And the other thing he said, whatever you put on the stage, it had better be the best. If you had to put a bedroom on stage, it would have to be the most beautiful brass bed as you could find. And so I learned very early on that you have to be absolutely precise about what you're putting on stage, because that's visual information. That's information that the audience, you're giving them visual information. And I think that's a lot of the time part of my job as well, you know, that they need to know how these people live or what this world is, and you have to let them into it somehow. You know?
Is it a question of striking the right balance between minimalism and maximalism?
I think so, yeah. I do have both of those aspects in me, I think. I do love detail. I do love colour. I do love fabrics. I do love beauty, I love sensuousness, and I do love empty spaces, especially when you go into a Romanesque church or something in Italy and it's just the purity of it and the scale of it.
The Romanesque is fine, but the Rococo...
I'm not a fan of Rococo. No. I'm not. I find that wedding cake stuff just too much. And so, you know, give me a quiet little Romanesque church as opposed to the Vatican any day of the week. Any day of the week.
We have a wonderful evocation, not of a Romanesque church, but of New York next, thanks to Joni Mitchell.
Oh, Joni. Where do I begin with Joni? Joni, like a lot of American artists of the time, you know, Paul Simon, I'm very, very influenced by all of that. Everything came, again, through the transistor radio. I take the transistor radio to bed at night with me, and I heard the pirate radio stations, and I got a lot of my musical knowledge from that, under the bedclothes. And Joni was a woman who started writing about her life and telling you in a very honest way, you know, she just wrote about what was happening to her. And so I've been a huge fan of her forever. This is a beautiful, beautiful song. It's like a travelogue, really. It begins with a line saying, I went to Staten Island to buy myself a mandolin, and thus starts a story about seeing a wedding dress on a storefront mannequin. And then she comes back to New York, and obviously a love affair is going wrong. So it's a very complicated, quite a long song, and we're probably not going to hear it all today, but it's like driving through a city or driving through an open landscape. It's very, very evocative. And also, the album cover is one of the best album covers she ever made.
I went to Staten Island, Sharon, to buy myself a mandolin. And I saw the long white dress of love on a storefront mannequin. Big boat chugging back with a belly full. Cars, all for something lacy. Some girl's gonna see that dress and crave that day like crazy. Little Indian kids on a bridge up in Canada, they can balance and they can climb. Off the girders of the Manhattan skyline. Shine your light on me, Miss Liberty, because as soon as this ferry boat docks, I'm headed to the church to play bingo. Fleece me with a gambler's flock. Fool when love's at stake, because I can't conceal emotion. What I'm feeling's always written on my face. There's a gypsy down on Bleecker Street. I wanted to see her as a kind of joke, and she lit a candle for my love lock, and 18 bucks went up in smoke. Repetitious danger. You think I'd be accustomed to? Well, I do accept the changes, at least better than I used to do.
It's a wonderful combination, that voice and that driving guitar.
I know, and she is skating on the cover. It's as if she's skating on ice all through this song and all through her life at that particular moment in time. It's going around and around. It's exquisite.
Song for Sharon by Joni Mitchell from her 1976 album, Gira. You're listening to Private Passions with my guest today, the set and costume designer, Bob Crowley. As the lights come up for the first time, Bob, on a production, a new production, do you still get a thrill?
I do. I still have that hunger in me to see things and be challenged by them and entranced by them and engulfed by them.
What do you think is the most complicated set you've ever designed? I have a possible thought in my mind. Nick Heitner's Carousel has been pretty spectacular.
Okay. I mean, Carousel meant so much to me because I grew up with that. We had all the Rodgers and Hammerstein LPs at home. And Carousel was the first big musical I ever did with Nick. We went on a road trip ourselves, actually, to Maine, where it's all set. We came across this Shaker community. There weren't very many of them left, called Sabbath Day Lake. And they had this beautiful meeting house. And this is where they used to commune and dance, pray and dance. And they'd painted the room blue, this very beautiful blue. It reminded them of heaven. And of course, Carousel, we end up in heaven. So that inspired the blue production that we did, which was all painted blue. The floor was painted blue, the walls were painted blue, and all these bright colours came in and out of it.
But you had a huge umbrella-like structure,
yes,
didn't
you? Yes,
that came.
The whole beginning was made in my studio, Nick, myself, and Kenneth Macmillan, the great Kenneth Macmillan. And we created that together, literally, by listening to the music again and again and again and breaking it down and breaking it down. It began with an image of a giant clock and a ticking down to when the workers would finish on their looms in the mill, and then they go to the fair, as it were, the carousel, and that all happened as you watched it, and it all came together on stage by the actors pushing it on with that glorious overture. And then at the very, very, very last minute, when all the horses were assembled, I flew in this giant kind of umbrella that expanded and opened out, like your arms opening out to embrace the world. But that's all from the music.
Yes, but you have to be the vessel through which the image passes.
Yeah, if you're lucky. It's just not always like that. But music helps, you know. It's hard not to be inspired by beautiful music.
So what have you chosen from Rodgers and Hammerstein?
I've chosen, you know, we've heard If You Love Me. Now we're hearing If I Loved You. It's the duet between Billy Bigelow and Julie Jordan, the first time they kind of get together. They mask their feelings for each other and they imagine if they were in love. And of course, they are totally in love. And this is it. This is If I Loved You.
Just the same. I know how it'd be if I loved you. When I worked in the mill, weaving at the loom, I'd gaze absent-minded at the roof. And half the time the shuttle would tangle in the threads and the warp would get mixed with the woof. If I loved you.
But you don't.
No, I don't. But somehow I can see just exactly how I'd be. I loved you. Time and again I would try to say all I'd want you to know. If I loved you, words wouldn't come in an easy way.
I never remember meeting a girl like you. Hey, are you trying to get me to marry you?
No.
Well, what's putting it into my head then? Yeah. Yeah, you're different, all right. I don't know what it is. You look up at me with that little kid's face like you trusted me. I wonder what it'd be like.
What?
Nothing. No, I know what it'd be like. It'd be awful.
Kinda scrawny and pale, picking at my food, and lovesick like any other guy. I'd throw away my sweater and dress up like a dude in a dickie and a collar and a tie if I loved you.
But you don't.
No, I don't. But somehow I can see just exactly how I'd be if I loved you. Time and again I would try to say,
Bob Crowley, that literally brought tears to your eyes, didn't it?
Yeah, every time. It's guaranteed every time. It's so beautiful. There's a really sweet anecdote about that, in that at the end of the song, it's all set in spring, they talk about the blossom and the wind, and she says, the blossoms, they're coming down by themselves. It must be their time too, I reckon. At which point, we auditioned this petal drop. I think it was 5 petals we settled on in the end. Exactly 5 petals had to come in on a certain note and fall, you know, from 50 feet in the air onto the Littleton stage. Anyway, there was one stagehand who was responsible for these 5 petals to fall every night. And he instantly became called Blossom by the rest of the stage crew. And to this day, he's known as Blossom.
So, yeah. Did he get it right?
He did. Bless him. Blossom.
If I Loved You, from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel, a track from the 1993 National Theatre original cast album with Michael Hayden and Joanna Riding. Carousel also transferred to Broadway in 94. I suppose you, on the whole, never know who's in the audience seeing your shows, but you did know that one of your heroes came to see it.
Yes, he did, you know, but there's nothing like having a hit in New York City. I mean, everybody comes to see it and you're just celebrated and you're invited everywhere suddenly by total strangers. And Paul Simon came to see it and I suddenly got a call one night at home, which was, I think my young brother was in the flat at the time with me. And I said, you've got to leave the room, you've got to leave the room. Mm-hmm. Paul Simon's just about to call me. I can't take a call with you in the room. Again, like Joni, Paul Simon, he's been a huge influence in my life. When I heard songs like The Dangling Conversation and he's singing to his girlfriend and she said, you know, you read your Emily Dickinson and I read my Robert Frost. I didn't know who Emily Dickinson and Robert Frost were when I heard that song, but I went out to the local library and got them the next day. So, you know, all this music just feeds in and it's like great artists open the world up to you, as you know, and he's one of them. And then I did end up doing a musical with him, yes, on Broadway, called The Cape Man, which the critics were less kind to than Carousel, let's put it that way.
Yes. Did you remain friends?
Yes, we are friends. And I remember saying years after it, because they were vicious to him on that occasion, I said, Paul, what, looking back now, what do you think about The Cape Man on Broadway? And he went, well, They beat me up and they took my money. That's it. There's nothing else to say.
Yeah.
He didn't have your regular Broadway pit session musicians, you know. He had his own musicians that came and played every night. And the way he just modulated the sound and the way he just orchestrated them like a great conductor, it was extraordinary to watch it. And he's so articulate about everything. There's nothing he doesn't know. He's an amazing, astonishing man, yeah.
We're going to hear a sea shanty next, but
yes,
with an extraordinary twist on it, because I think it was in 1908 that John Perring, a deep sea sailor from Dartmouth, sang this, and Percy Grainger made something in a way quite different but very moving from it.
First time I heard this, I was in my kitchen at home listening to your programme, I think. It made me stop in my tracks, literally made me stop in my tracks. The hairs went up at the back of my head and I didn't know what it was. And I thought it was Benjamin Britten.
There is something Grimesian, yeah, about the whole thing of the sailor and this song of yearning.
Yeah, it's just arresting.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. And I can see why you were confused when you first heard it, Bob. Shallow Brown, actually, some people think is a stretch of water, but it's a song that was collected and arranged by Percy Grainger, performed by John Shirley Quirk, who, of course, was a Great Britain
artist. That's right, I knew the connection, yes. Wasn't sure.
The Ambrosian Singers and the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Benjamin Britten, and he did not conduct things he did not think were great. So, and he gives it that fantastic rhythmic impetus. I think it's a great song, actually.
It is a great song, but it also sounds like it's ancient and contemporary.
When I was a student, John Shirley Quirk was having vocal maintenance lessons with my teacher, so I had to sit outside and hear that wonderful voice and then go in and croak in my...
And what a voice!
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's all-encompassing, that voice. You just have to listen to it.
Bob, you worked with Disney on the sets for Tarzan, Mary Poppins, Aladdin.
I did.
All involving some airborne delights.
Yeah.
How important is it to evoke that childlike magic, do you think, on stage?
Essential. They're not called plays for nothing. It's that ability to tap into that kind of childlike ability to believe in something that isn't real. And I still have that kind of innate delight in things, having to invent and make things up. I love it. I think an audience should be given a space that they can use their imagination as well, so you don't fill in all the squares or the dots or the...
Is that why you like radio?
I'm absolutely obsessed with the radio. Anyone who knows me and knows where I've lived will know that in every single room there's a Roberts radio, if not two, because I have a stereo on Roberts radio. I mean, I know I can do it on my phone, I know I can do it on the sound system, but I carry a radio around with me sometimes in the house.
You picked Gershwin, An American in Paris, next.
Yes.
A musical I imagine you've worked on.
I did it in Paris about 10 years ago, and then we took it to Broadway and then brought it back here to London.
How tricky was it to put Paris on the stage?
That's an understatement. Are you kidding me? Putting Paris in front of the Parisians? Oh, my God. It was terrifying. It's the most designed city. So I used these two flying pieces that created different avenues all the time. And so you kept looking down all these large boulevards, or you were confronted by the front of the building and didn't touch the floor. So it was as if they were dancing as well. But the one thing I didn't want to see was the Eiffel Tower. I said, we're not over my dead body. Are we seeing the Eiffel Tower in this musical until the last kind of 10 seconds of the evening? Just keep them bloody waiting, you know.
And, but you did have the Seine.
So we did have the Seine, yes, we did have the Seine, but I did love those beautiful Morris columns, which are like pillars for posters in Paris, and they're on every street, and they're just exquisite. And we put them on wheels, and they whizzed around everywhere, and they became part of the show. And at the very, very end, you do get a version of the Eiffel Tower, but begrudgingly.
Yes, but you can't resist this music, can you? It's so
joyous.
Oh
my God, it's a celebration of a city.
An American in Paris by Gershwin, performed by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Bob Crowley, your younger brother John's a theatre and film director. Did you ever work together?
Only once, a production of Into the Woods together at the Donmar Warehouse. We both got to work with one of our heroes, Stephen Sondheim.
Do you have a favourite number from Sondheim?
I do. I mean, again, one spot for choice here. I mean, I did prevaricate over several of them. But I do love A Little Night Music. And I saw it when it first opened in London. And it involves various lovers and infidelities and crossovers. And it's a very complicated story. But they're all being invited to a weekend in the country. And it could go either way. Let's put it that way.
Here, ma'am, delivered by hand. And, ma'am, I notice the stationery's engraved and very grand. Petra, how too exciting, just when I need it. Petra, such elegant writing, so chic, you hardly can read it. What do you think? Who can it be? Even the ink, no, here, let me. Your presence, just think of it, Petra, is kindly, it's at a chateau, requested, etc., etc. Madam Leonora Arms, oh no! A weekend in the country, we're invited. What a horrible plot. A weekend in the country, I'm excited. No, you're not. A weekend in the country, just imagine. It's completely depraved. A weekend in the country, it's insulting. It's engraved. Is that woman, is that arm belt on the actress? Oh, the goal. She may hope to make a charm belt, but she's mad if she thinks I would be such a fool as to weekend in the country. How insulting. And I'm nothing to where a weekend in the country. Here, the last place I'm going is there. Guess what an invitation. Yes, who begins with an A? Our belt is at a relation to the decrepit Desiree. Guess when we're asked to go, sir, see, sir, the date there. Guess where a fancy chateau, sir. Guess two who's lying in wait. They're setting her traps, fixing her.
Darling, perhaps a change of pace.
Oh,
a
no.
Weekend in the country would be charming, and the air would be fresh.
A weekend with that woman
in the country,
in the flesh.
I've some business with her mother.
It's business. Oh, no, don't. But the business with her mother would be hardly the business I'd worry about.
Just a weekend in the country, smelling jasmine,
watching little things grow.
A weekend in the country.
Go.
My darling will simply say no.
Oh. A weekend.
How very amusing.
A weekend.
But also inept.
A weekend, of course, we're refusing.
Au contraire, you must accept.
Oh, no.
A weekend in the country.
But it's frightful.
No, you don't understand. A weekend in the country is delightful if it's planned. Wear your hair down and a flower. Don't use makeup, dress in white. She'll grow older by the hour and be hopelessly shattered by Saturday night. Spend a weekend in the country.
We'll accept it.
I'd a feeling you would. A weekend in the country.
Yes, it's only polite that we should.
Good.
Well?
I've an intriguing little social item.
What?
Out at the Armfelt family manse.
Well, what?
Merely a weekend, still I thought it might amuse you to know who's invited to go, this time with his pants.
You don't mean...
I'll give you three guesses.
She wouldn't.
Reduce it to two.
It can't be.
It nevertheless is...
Big a month.
Right, score one for you.
Aha!
Aha!
Aha. A weekend in the country, we should try it.
How I wish we'd been asked.
A weekend in the country, peace and quiet.
We'll go masked.
A weekend in the country.
Uninvited, they'll consider it odd.
A weekend in the country, I'm delighted.
Oh my God.
And the shooting should be pleasant if the weather's not too rough. Happy birthday, it's your present.
But
you haven't been getting out nearly enough. And a weekend in the country,
it's perverted.
Pack my quiver and bow.
A weekend in the country,
hurt. Exactly 2:30 we go.
You can't,
shall.
You shan't.
I'm getting the car and we're motoring down.
Yes, I'm certain you are and I'm staying in town.
No,
I won't. You should pack everything quite.
how delightfully droll. A weekend in the country while we're losing our control. A weekend in the country, how enchanting on the manicure knobs. A weekend in the country with the panting and the yawns. With the crickets and the pheasants and the orchards and the hay. With the servants and the peasants who'll be laying our plans while we're playing croquet. For a weekend in the country, so inactive that one has to lie down. A weekend in the country
in the country, yeah, by Sondheim, performed by the original Broadway cast conducted by Harold Hastings. Bob, when you hear that, of course, you hear a brilliant mind at work, a lyricist and a composer.
Yeah, where the music and the lyrics are just in complete synchronicity with each other, you know, and it's also the most astonishing end to an act, furthering the story at an incredible rate. And, you know, a weekend in the country, smelling jasmine, watching little things grow. I mean, you know, the double entendres in it as well are just brilliant.
And I love the, oh no.
I know. It's just so witty and joyous.
Since you began to work in the theatre, Bob, we've seen huge developments in stage technology. Audiences are really quite used to seeing video projections, live video, hugely complex stage lighting effects. What's your attitude to all of this? Do you enjoy using it, or do you think it can be used too much?
It's a question of taste, I think. All of these things are extremely useful. I'm not a Luddite. It can be really brilliant. I just don't rely on it for everything. And I think you have to use these things at your discretion. I would still constantly come back to a beautifully lit empty space with a fabulous actor and a fabulous script. It never gets any better when you add stuff in. Stuff gets added because you need more information for the audience sometimes. And it's a different expectation. You know, if you go to see a big musical these days, you know, the audience expects to see something they can't see at home, you know, and rightly so. And they want value for money because it's so expensive now to go and see shows.
Well, let's have your final choice, because sadly we have to bring the curtain down soon.
Honestly, the less I say about this, the more I think really it's Schubert and it's the Litany, Feast of All Souls. It's just a sort of meditation, really. It's a meditation, a musical meditation. It's exquisite, and there's not a spare moment or note in it. This is what I was talking about when theatre is completely stripped away. You have a great piece of music, and you've got a great singer and a great musician, and this is what you get. This is art at its highest. It's amazing. It's just astonishing.
Bob Crowley, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Schubert's Litany for the Feast of All Souls, performed by Matthias Görner and Helmut Deutsch on the piano. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the theatre and costume designer Bob Crowley. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael's going to be talking to the composer and musicologist Gerard McBurney. Next on Radio 3, Sarah Moore-Peach is taking us on a musical journey in Music Map.
BBC Radio 3, the home of live classical music. A cosmic programme spanning time and space, with the Halle Orchestra conducted by Thomas Addis. Featuring two of his own works, alongside one of the most influential pieces of the 20th century, Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring. A surging, thunderous tribute to renewal. Radio 3 in concert, The Rite of Spring from Manchester. Thursday nights from 7:30. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
This is Radio 3. We're celebrating spring in the Early Music Show at 5 as Hannah French continues to mark the 300th anniversary of the publication of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Jazz Record Requests is before that at 4, and Choral Evensong comes from Leeds Cathedral at 3. Time now, though, on Radio 3 for Music Map. Here's Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we trace the contour lines which connect all music together. In every episode, we work our way towards a single chosen piece of classical music through a landscape of other sounds that help set it in context. And today, we're headed for the Polovtsian Dances by the Russian composer Alexander Borodin. At the end of the show, we'll hear the full sequence of Polovtsian dances, which come from Borodin's opera Prince Igor. So let's begin now with some other dance sequences from the world of opera. First up, back to the French Baroque stage and the opera ballets of Jean-Philippe Rameau.